I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Gretchen Rubin had it pretty good as a clerk to Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, but her tendency to fixate on a question and then research it obsessively led Rubin to leave law and become a writer. Since then, she's become a best-selling author on the pursuit of happiness and good habits. Today, I speak with Gretchen Rubin on her latest book, The Four Tendencies. How we respond to others and our own expectations reveals a lot about what motivates us. Understanding our reactions, says Gretchen Rubin, can lead to better decisions and less stress in our lives. So are you an upholder, an obliger, a questioner, or a rebel? Find out on Up to Date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We all know that some things are supposed to make us happier and our lives better, getting a good night's sleep, eating right, and exercising, and spending time with friends and family. But what makes some of these things so hard to do, and why does advice that works for one person fall flat with another? That is what New York Times bestselling author Gretchen Rubin has been trying to figure out. Her new book, which came out yesterday, The Four Tendencies, the Indispensable Personality Profiles that Reveal How to Make Your Life Better and Other People's Lives Better Too, tries to drive to the bottom of why what works for one person drives someone else crazy. Gretchen, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you.
I'm so happy to be talking to you.
What are the four tendencies, Gretchen?
So it's upholder, questioner, obliger, and rebel.
Give us some definitions for each one, because you and I share something here. We're both upholders.
Oh, good. There's not many upholders. That's good.
Yes.
It's always nice to meet another one. So this has to do with how you respond to expectations. And all of us face outer expectations, which are things like a work deadline or requests from a friend, and inner expectations, which is like our own desire to meet a New Year's resolution, our own desire to get back into practicing meditation. So upholders, whether you and I, readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline, they keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what's expected of them by others, but their expectations for themselves are just as important.
And that fits me to a T, just for the record.
Excellent. Okay. I love talking to a fellow upholder. Then there are questioners. Questioners question all expectations. So they make everything an inner expectation. If it meets their inner standard, they will follow an expectation. And if it fails to meet their standard, they will resist. So they hate anything arbitrary or inefficient or irrational. Their first question is, why should I? Then obligers.
Obligers, yes.
Yeah. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. And I got my big insight into this tendency when a friend said, the weird thing is, I know I'd be happier if I exercised, and when I was in high school, I was on the track team, and I never missed track practice, so why can't I go running now? Well, when she had a team and a coach expecting her, she had no trouble showing up, but when she was just trying to go on her own, she struggles.
And her dilemma, Gretchen, was what got you thinking about all this to begin with, if I understand right.
Absolutely. This conversation, although this is a very kind of familiar dilemma, I think, you hear a lot of people saying this. Somehow when she said that, my mind was blown and I was like, I must understand what's going on here. Like now my I must plumb to the heart of this mystery. And then finally, rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. And if you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to resist. And typically, they don't even like to tell themselves what to do. So those are the four. And you and I are upholders. Rebel is the smallest tendency. It's the one the fewest people belong to, but upholder only slightly larger. So you and I are kind of, we're sort of rare types. There aren't that many upholders. The biggest one is obliger, and after that, questioner.
And I like being a rare type, Gretchen, just for the record. That's not a bad thing to be. Yeah. Well, why is it important to figure all this out and to have these categories for all human beings here?
I think it's natural, and it's very hard not to just assume that everybody sees the world more or less the way we do. And I think what's helpful about the four tendencies is it really shines a spotlight on how people might respond differently in different situations, or how they might react differently to different situations. And so if there's something about yourself that's frustrating you, or there's something that's leading to conflict with another person or frustration with another person, like you're a doctor and you can't get your patients to take their blood pressure medication, or you're a teacher and you've got a really smart student who refuses to do the homework. A lot of times, if you understand the four tendencies, you get a very clear sense of what might be going on. And once you know what the issue is, then of course it's much easier to fix it or to offset it. Where if you don't understand what's going on, it's very hard to do anything about it because you don't really have a very clear sense of what's causing the problem.
We're visiting with best-selling author Gretchen Rubin about her new book, The Four Tendencies. How did you come up with this framework, Gretchen, these four categories of upholder, rebel, questioner, and obliger?
Well, you know, it just about melted my brain. It's like the hardest intellectual thing I've ever done. It came about because I was writing my book Better Than Before, which is all about habit change. And I was starting to pick up these patterns about what people said about habits and how what kind of struggles they had. And I was trying to make sense of it. Like my friend on the track team, people would say to me like, oh, I can always make time for other people, but I can't make time for myself. Well, that didn't resonate with me. I have no trouble making time for myself. So what's going on? Or then there were people where if I would talk to them about New Year's resolutions, they would say in almost exactly the same words, they would say, I would keep a resolution if it made sense, but I wouldn't wait for New Year's Eve because January 1st is an arbitrary date. So the arbitrariness of January 1st had never bothered me. And then I noticed, you know, talking to people about habits and my view about habits, some people were sort of repelled by this idea of embracing a life of habits and trying to build more habits into your life. They were like, oh my gosh, who wants to be chained like that? So I sensed all these deep patterns and how people were responding. But it wasn't until I really understood, kind of in a flash, that this idea of expectations was at the core of what was going on, that I was able to see how all these people fit into different groups and how those groups interrelated to each other. It took me a long, long time to sort of put all the pieces together. Huh.
Well, Gretchen Rubin is the author of The Four Tendencies, the indispensable personality profiles that reveal how to make your life better and other people's lives better, too. It's time for a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Gretchen Rubin. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting with author Gretchen Rubin about her new book, The Four Tendencies. You know, one thing, Gretchen, that helped me wrap my arms around these four different groups of people is your light bulb questions. Can you run those by us?
Oh, you mean the light bulb jokes?
The light bulb jokes that you use to describe these different people.
Right. So the question is, how do you get an upholder to change a light bulb? They've already changed it. You ask a questioner to change a light bulb and they say, why should I? You ask an obliger to change a light bulb and they say, you know, I'll do it if you make me. And the rebel says, change your own light bulb.
Which is a great way to think about these groups, right?
Yeah. 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 No, the funny thing is once you see the differences, they're very stark. It's not a subtle thing. I'm kind of amazed that no one has picked up on this before in the whole history of mankind, as far as I can tell, because once you pick it out, it's really obvious how, like, upholders are different from rebels or how questioners are different from obligers. They really do have a very fundamentally different way of seeing the world.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. And since I messed around with the book the last couple of days, I'm looking at the people I work with. I'm looking at my wife. I'm looking at my neighbors. And it's not hard to peg people. And I should point out that you have like, what, 12 or 13 questions, just a simple test you can take in the book that will clarify for you pretty quickly where you are on this scale.
Right. And there's a quiz online. The same quiz is online if people want to do it at happiercast.com/quiz. And like, I don't know, more than 800,000 people have taken it now. But I think often people don't even really need to take a quiz. Even a very brief description is enough for them to be like, oh, yeah, that's me, or oh, yeah, that's him, or that's her.
And you're so right. I was reading the book, and when you got to the part where you described the four tendencies, one of the first ones was upholder. And I thought, bingo, I don't have to go any further. That's exactly who I am, you know. You talked about these tendencies, as you mentioned in your last book, Better Than Before. Why did they need their own book, Gretchen?
Well, you know, it's interesting because after Better Than Before came out, in that book, I identified the 21 strategies that we can use to make or break habits. And so using the four tendencies was just one of 21 strategies. So it wasn't a very big part of that book, but it's when I introduced the framework. And the minute that book went out into the world, I just became deluged with people asking me questions. Teachers who wanted to use it in the classroom, doctors and other healthcare professionals who were like telling me how they were already using it or how they wanted to use it or asking questions, or like people, you know, in relationships or people trying to figure out how to manage themselves better. And often, you know, they were asking questions like, oh, you got to help me, or they were giving me insights and observations. And it was just absolutely fascinating. But I realized, you know, I was writing a lot of emails back to people and I kept thinking, I really need to really fully tackle this because, well, it's very easy to sketch out the basics of it. There are nuances that become very clear, patterns that become very clear, that I wanted to have enough time to really sort of take people through it in a systematic way, not just in this podcast episode of Happier or in this blog post or in this email, but really kind of like explain it all in some kind of, you know, symmetrical way, just because people really get it. Mm-hmm. And they wanted more information. Yeah.
Well, one of the things you do in this book, and we've already gotten to some of it here, is to break down some strategies that parents and spouses and coworkers and even doctors might use with different types of people. First, why is knowing what motivates yourself and others so important?
Well, if you want to do a better job of getting yourself to do something, you have to understand, like, well, maybe why aren't you doing something? Or why is somebody not taking your great advice? You know, what is the issue? And all of us sort of naturally assume that people see the world the way we do. And when you understand the four tendencies, you might think like, well, I am trying to reach my patient or convince my patient, or I'm trying to reach my student by doing what would work for me. But when I read the four tendencies, I realize like, oh, I'm dealing with somebody else. Let me try a different strategy. That strategy might work better for that person.
Just give us a couple thoughts here. If you want to work effectively with an upholder, again, this is someone like myself, like yourself, who deals and often meets and exceeds inner expectations as well as outer expectations, you would do what?
Well, one thing you want to remember with upholders is they typically don't have a lot of flexibility. They don't value spontaneity, and they like to stick to whatever they have planned and what they're wanting to do.
Yep.
So if you're dealing with an upholder, you wouldn't want to like say, hey, let's take the afternoon off, or, oh, you know, I just had a great idea. Or I was just speaking to a rebel boss who was saying with her team, like, she'd be like, hey, we're all talking about this. Let's like, quick, let's all sit down and have a staff meeting in the middle of the afternoon. I'd see, like, as an upholder, that would make me very uneasy. Cause I'm like, well, from 3 to 5, I was planning on working on the annual report, but now we're having this meeting. And so, ooh, I can't, like, my mind is like, that's too much. So that's one thing you would want to keep in with an upholder. Like there's great strength to that with an upholder tendency, but of course every strength also has its kind of corresponding weakness.
Well, Gretchen, you are speaking to me and I'm thinking we have a future together because you just described me again to a T. How about questioners, people who respond to inner expectations but struggle with outer expectations?
The crucial thing for questioners is to remember that they want justifications. They want to know why they're being expected to do something, either from themselves or from other people. And so you want to give them robust explanations. So if you're dealing with a little kid who's saying, well, why should I memorize the multiplication tables? I could just look it up on my iPhone in a flash. Like, why do I have to memorize it? Or you're dealing with, a healthcare patient who's like, I don't understand why you want me to walk a half an hour every morning. You really want to take the time to give that person the robust explanations that they need in order to meet an expectation. So to say something like, this is the standard protocol. I'm your teacher. This is what fourth graders always do because I say so, because I'm your boss. That's not going to work for the questioner. They need reasons.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about obligers and rebels, and especially rebels, how to deal with those folks who resist all expectations, both inner and outer. Again, our guest, Gretchen Rubin, the author of The Four Tendencies. Our guest, best-selling author Gretchen Rubin, the author of The Four Tendencies, the indispensable personality profiles that reveal how to make your life better and other people's lives better, too. Gretchen, we cut it off right in the middle of our four tendencies in terms of how to deal with obligers and with rebels. Let's talk about obligers who meet outer expectations but struggle with inner expectations. How do you deal with them, and how do you motivate those people?
So the crucial thing to remember about obligers is that they respond to outer expectations. So if they are struggling with an inner expectation or they're struggling to do something, it might be that what you need is more outer accountability. So if you're an obliger yourself and let's say you're having trouble exercising, instead, like my friend, instead of just trying to go exercise on your own, you'd say, I'm going to take a class where I'm going to pay and where the teacher's going to notice if I don't show up. Or I'm going to meet a friend who's going to be annoyed if I don't show. Or I'm going to think about my duty to be a role model and model healthy behavior for other members of my household. Or I'm going to go with my dog who's going to be so sad if he doesn't have a chance to go running outside, or I'm going to raise money for a charity that's really important to me by participating in this 5K. There's a million ways to get outer accountability, but you just want to make sure they're in there. Now, sometimes, like say in a work environment, if you have a non-obliger boss, they might not understand the importance of accountability. And so an upholder like you or me might say something to somebody that they work with like, hey, when you have a little bit of time, would you run those numbers for me? You know, no rush, just whenever you get around to it, just let me know. And then to an obliger, they might be like, is that even really an assignment? Like, that's so open-ended. Like, when am I going to do that? Never. Whereas to an upholder, it's like, oh, well, that's just as clear. You know, like, how can you not do that? I just asked you to do that. And so you might say to yourself, well, or like a questioner might say, well, you know, if something's important to you, you should just do it. If it makes sense, do it. If not, don't do it. Why should I have to hold you accountable? Because it's a lot of work to hold people accountable. Yeah. But if you know that people are an obliger, you could say they need that. And they need that in order to thrive and succeed. And so we need to find ways to create the accountability that's going to allow them to follow through. The other thing about obligers, though, that's very important for people to recognize is that when obligers are meeting too many expectations, when expectations are too high or unrealistic, when obligers feel exploited or taken advantage of or ignored, they can fall into something called obliger rebellion, which is when they meet an expectation, and then suddenly they snap, and they're like, well, this I won't do. So it might be something small, like I'm not going to return your emails, or it might be something huge, like I'm going to quit my job, or I'm going to blow up our friendship of 20 years because I can't take it anymore. So we want it, when we're dealing with obligers, we really want to make sure that they don't get taken advantage of, because they do get taken advantage of, and they don't get to this place of deep resentment and burnout, because obliger rebellion, while it's meant to be constructive and kind of be the escape parachute that allows obligers to get out of overly burdensome situations, which it does, it can often have destructive effects, because to the outside world, it can seem like, oh my gosh, why are you doing this? Why are you reacting in this way? Even to obligers themselves, it can seem like that. They often say that they feel like they're exploding, they're acting out of character. It doesn't feel controlled. It feels like an eruption.
Okay, finally then, there's the category of rebel who simply defies all expectations, both outer and inner. How do you deal with someone like that, Gretchen?
Well, you know, somebody I know who's married to a rebel said, I finally realized after 20 years that the less I ask for, the more I get. So there's two ways of thinking about dealing with rebels. One is rebels can do anything they choose to do. They can do anything they want to do. So you can remind them of their identity. So let's say you're dealing with a rebel boss. You could say something like, well, you know, when you don't come to the staff meetings, it makes the staff feel like you don't care what they think and that your time is more valuable than their time. So then it's just a question of what kind of person you be, what kind of boss do you want to be? So then the rebel might think like, I don't want to be the kind of boss that makes people feel belittled and unheard. You know, I want to do something differently. Or to a younger kid, you could say something like, oh, it's fun to practice, you know, the piano because you have a great musical sense that you want to communicate. And they're like, yeah, I want to be that person. I want to be a musician. So I'm going to practice because this is going to help me be the kind of person that I want to be. Another thing that can work with rebels is information, consequences, choice. You give the rebel the information they need. You tell them the consequences of their action or their inaction, and then you allow them to choose. And importantly, you do not save or rescue them from negative consequences that might fall from their decision. You have to allow them to experience that negative consequence. So, like, again, to say a little kid, to take an easy example, if you have a little kid going outside on a hot day, you could say, look, if you go outside on a bright sunny day, you can get a bad sunburn. bad sunburn really hurts. Your skin can even blister and peel. And then you're stuck inside until your sunburn goes away while all your friends are out playing. Do you feel like wearing a baseball cap and a long sleeve t-shirt? Or do you feel like wearing sunscreen lotion?
Yeah.
And then that's just information, consequences, choice. And then it's up to the rebel. And then they can decide for themselves. Usually, you know, and don't nag them and don't remind them. Often when people complain about rebels, like, oh, I keep reminding my spouse to do this and they just won't do it. I'm like, you're probably stopping them. If you tell them to do it, then they're like, well, you're not the boss of me. And then they won't.
You know, Gretchen, just quickly, you call these tendencies. Does that mean there's some wiggle room here?
Well, I do believe that everybody has an inborn tendency and that each of us fits into a core tendency, but they do overlap with each other, and that's where you see kind of variations within a tendency. So to take our tendency, for example, the upholder tendency overlaps with obligers because we both upholders and obligers meet outer expectations, but we also overlap with questioners and that we both readily meet inner expectations. And so some upholders are more on the questioner side of things and some are more on the obliger side of things. And so you get sort of differences in intensity and variations in how it looks. And then also it's very important to remember, this is just one very narrow aspect of a personality. And so you could have 50 obligers lined up, and depending on how intellectual they were, how considerate they were, how ambitious they were, how extroverted or introverted they were, how adventurous they were, how neurotic they were, they would look very different from each other. But as to how they responded to expectations, in that way they would be alike. It's a small thing, but it's a very significant thing, but it doesn't account for every kind of aspect of the way you come across in the world.
Gretchen Rubin is my guest. Her new book, The Four Tendencies, will be back in just a few minutes, and I'll ask Gretchen about how she went from law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor to writer. And we're back with New York Times bestselling author Gretchen Rubin, author of The Four Tendencies. Before you became a writer, Gretchen, you were a clerk for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. What kind of advice did she give you?
You know, many years after I left my clerkship, I asked Justice O'Connor what she thought the secret to happiness was. And she had an answer for me right away, a very short, succinct answer, which is very much in keeping with her personality, which was work worth doing. She said that was the secret to a happy life, was work worth doing. And so, you know, I think Justice O'Connor, she was, you know, thought anything worth doing and worth doing well was something that was worth pursuing.
What was it like working for the first woman Supreme Court justice in American history?
You know, Justice O'Connor didn't really talk about that aspect of it very much. I mean, she was just very much herself. And in that way, she was a great model because Justice O'Connor was just like Justice O'Connor all the way through. Just like she made her female clerks take aerobics class with her. And it was just like, that's what she did. She had funny, quirky things. Like she made us all, one of the responsibilities of her clerks each year was to decorate the Halloween pumpkins, which is just sort of like, it's like, that's not what you think you're going to be doing when you're going to the Supreme Court, but hey, we had a great time. She wasn't a person who kind of opined on things like that very much. She's a very practical person, a very pragmatic person, and kind of like, let's just get the job done. And that was definitely the atmosphere in her chambers.
Did you have a sense that at the time that she was an historic figure and this was someone, you were working with someone who would wind up in the history books one day?
Well, I had a funny experience. So one of the things about Justice O'Connor, she put a very big emphasis on birthdays. And every time somebody in her chambers had a birthday, it was like a big celebration. It was marked. So the year before I got there, her clerks had given her a birthday book, which, you know, you've seen these books where it's like it's every day of the year and their birthstone and important historical events and zodiac sign and all this kind of it's like an encyclopedia of birthday information. So they'd given that to her the year before. So all year, as the birthdays had been unfolding, we'd been looking at it and kind of saying, like, reading out tidbits from people's birthdays. So when her birthday came, she said to me, okay, look in the birthday book and tell me who was born on my birthday. And I opened it up and I held it up and I was like, it's you, Justice. And the big picture of like what celebrity was born on this day was Justice O'Connor. And she got a very strange look on her face at that moment. And so I think sometimes she did really grapple with the idea that she was this iconic historical figure. But I think a lot, she was a very pragmatic person, really. She was like, I'm here to do a great job for the American people. I'm here to do, you know, to do what's right according to my own lights. And, you know, she didn't really think about things like that in that way, at least that I was aware of too much.
How did you go? How did you make the transition from a career in law to writing about happiness and habits?
Well, that writing about happiness was my fourth book. So mm-hmm. It took me a while to get there, but all my books were really about human nature. I got started the year that I was clerking for Justice O'Connor. One thing that happens to me frequently is I will become obsessed with a subject and do huge amounts of research. This is something that has happened to me my whole life. And at that time, I became obsessed with the subject that I called power, money, fame, sex, which was to me like this unified set of ideas, which, of course, is very much about human nature. So I was staying late and doing all this research. I was checking out books from the Library of Congress. This is like a little known perk of being a Supreme Court justice. Why they thought I was checking out these books, I don't know. And then finally, at some point, I realized, you know, I'm doing the kind of thing that a person would do to write a book. And there are people who write books as their job, not as like something that they're doing in their free time on the weekends and after work. And so maybe I should think about becoming a writer. And then I literally went to the bookstore and bought a book called like How to Write and Sell Your Nonfiction Book Proposal. And I followed the directions in a very upholder way. I just was like, okay, this is what I got to do. I will just do it. It was a long process.
Was it difficult as an upholder to make this kind of switch?
No, because one of the things about being an upholder is as long as inner voices, inner expectations are articulated, they have equal weight to outer expectations. But it's very important that those inner expectations be articulated. And so I think when I didn't know what I wanted to do, I was like, okay, I'll be a lawyer. I'll keep my options open. It's a great education. I'm good at research and writing. I can always change my mind later. I can see how I would do law school and that career. And so I just did it because I didn't know that I wanted to be a writer. But once I began to have this thought, maybe I really do want to be a writer. Maybe I'm actually writing a book without realizing it. Oh, my sister's a professional writer. Maybe I could be a professional writer too. And I came to the point of thinking, well, you know what? Now is the time to give it a go. And I would rather fail as a writer than succeed as a lawyer. So I had better give it a shot. It was easy for me to follow that inner expectation once I heard that voice.
You mentioned your sister. You have a podcast with her called Happier with Gretchen Rubin. Again, she co-hosted. Elizabeth Kraft is your co-host, and she's a television writer. Why is it important to have her on the podcast with you?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Elizabeth is an obliger, and we show how different people think about these issues differently, about happiness and how to be happier, healthier, more productive, more creative. And she's very different. And also, by the way, I've always called her my sister the sage because she's always saying these incredibly wise things, which then I follow along behind her and write them down. So it's great to have another voice and another perspective as we're talking about it, because the one thing that I've learned and everything I've done in this area of happiness, you know, largely, is that there is no one right way. There's no one best way. It's whatever worked for you. And so hearing from different people's perspectives is often very helpful because you think, well, I think, you know, a lot of times people will say, I'm more like Elizabeth. You know, they identify with her more than me or vice versa. So two voices allow you to have that more, a greater range of experience and insights.
Gretchen Rubin's new book, The Four Tendencies. Gretchen, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for the time.
Oh, thanks. It was so fun to talk to you.
You bet.